this is where my journey really started, mm-hmm. To gain awareness of my light skin privilege.
Military Wife Matters, Episode 7, Crossing the Cultural Divide, Part 2. Hello, I am Sakina Bunch, your relationship health and wellness coach. Welcome to Military Wife Matters, where we delve into the real life issues concerning military wives across the nation. Last episode, we talked with Sarah Urbano, wife to now veteran Jamie Urbano. She gave us a glimpse into their life together, working through and seeing life through the cultural differences that each faced during their various duty assignments in the Army. Let's get back to part two of our conversation.
It was extremely humbling. This is where my journey really started, mm-hmm. To gain awareness of my light skin privilege. I was really clueless. That bubble that I said I lived in was just being poked out a little bit until it popped, and it really needed to, and I'm glad that it did. But to your question about were we treated differently on base, being interracial, no, I wouldn't say that at all, because, you know, there's the phrase in the Army, you know, there's no black, there's no white, there's no this, there's not, there's just different shades of green. Mm-hmm. And there's so much truth to that. I think, you know, being, on a military island, Guam has, Anderson Air Force Base in the north, mm-hmm. Naval Base Guam in the, you know, kind of South Central Peninsula, Guam National Guard, there's Army. It's a military island, and people come and people go. You just get everybody and everything there. It's just, oh man. Mm-hmm. It's going to sound cliche, but it's like the best sushi roll possible. Like, you've got everything that's, you know, it's not, everything is unique, but mm-hmm. when you just put it all together, it just makes something really, really awesome. Mm-hmm. And so I never felt out of place there being an interracial couple. Though I will say, we chose not to live on base when we went to Guam. I'm not very big on the isolation, and I did learn that after being at Fort Monmouth for 6 years, that there could just be, there's so much exclusivity living on base, knowing that we were going to this place that was so magical. Mm-hmm. It just felt right to just live out in town.
Okay.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, I miss that place. Oh, you're sending me down memory lane.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Oh my gosh.
So you alluded earlier about the differences between your family and Jamie's family. Now, sure, I know, you know, my husband and I, we're of the same race, and we've had difficulty relating to one another because, mm-hmm. you know, his family did things in a certain way, and my family did things probably completely the opposite. Okay. And that oftentimes we would butt heads on things because of that. Mm-hmm. So did you find that there was more of a gap than you had anticipated within your culture and your husband's culture? Two-part question. And then the second part of that is, if so, please explain to our listeners the process you and your husband underwent to bridge that gap of culture and identity.
Sure. Like any relationship, there's always compromise. That sounds super cliche, but it's very important. You know, in a true compromise, nobody gets completely what they want. And in the situation of culture, it just made sense to me to really incorporate so much of Filipino culture into our family, mm-hmm. because it was a stronger culture. It's older, you know, the U.S. is how old it is, and all these other nations have been around so much longer. So many traditions and languages are just so rich and deeply rooted. And because I didn't really feel any sense of culture, I mean, I'm from New Jersey. What's culture there? Food trucks, food trucks. The stinky
got the shore. Got the shore.
Yeah, the shore. Yeah. Well, you know, and we can thank Jersey Shore for really sullying that Jersey tradition.
Yeah, and they were from Staten Island.
Right? They weren't even. Some of the kids weren't even from Jersey. Anyway, I'm not going to hate on them. I won't hate on them. To each their own. You know. I felt such. I did not feel a strong personal identity connected to culture. And for whatever reason, I was so drawn to Jamie and to his culture. And so I really pulled in any way that I can, just practices and traditions. And I was happy to do that. And I knew that I wanted my children to learn as much, you know, Tagalog as possible. And while Jamie was a little self-conscious to speak with them, I really took I'm proud of the initiative I took to learn what I could, mm-hmm. and to just share some key phrases with the girls. And I did the best that I could with that without having somebody to really converse with. But, you know, food, incorporating food, certain practices and customs. And there's this really beautiful tradition in Jamie's family, not his family, it's in Filipino culture, where elders are blessed, where you take their hand and you touch it to their forehead. And you might do this with your parents, to your grandparents, to any person who's older than you, you know, by a margin, or someone who's very special to you, like, let's say, a godparent or so forth. So this is something that we incorporated in raising our children, you know, and it's very special and touching to see that we've taken and shared that practice with my family. So there's so much beauty. There's so much beauty to that, but there are some challenges as well, because, it's, how do I say it? Well, I can give an example. I think I can start with that. At family functions with my husband's family, it's just super common for people to fall into the tongue they're most comfortable with. So Tagalog is just, you know, always being spoken at family events. Where I found it challenging is that, I felt not uneasy, left out maybe, when these conversations were happening, not around me, but when I'm sitting at a table with a group of people and we're all talking, and then the conversation would break off into Tagalog, and I'm nowhere near fluent. I know some key phrases, some naughty words. I can get the gist of whom you're talking about, if mm-hmm. you're talking about me, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, but nowhere near conversational. And so I found that not offensive, but I didn't like it. And I felt like it was inconsiderate. You know, if anybody were to come into my home, I would always just try to make them feel very welcome and comfortable. I would do my best to be accommodating. And I've experienced that with other families, you know, a Spanish speaking family that I know from the Dominican Republic. You know, the entire family is at least bilingual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they invite me over, they could easily do the same thing and just chit chat in Spanish, fall into whatever's comfortable for them. But they said, no, you know, we're not going to speak Spanish in front of you because you're here and you're not fluent in Spanish. And we want you to feel comfortable here. Mm-hmm. Even if I wasn't part of the conversation. And I was very touched by that. And, you know, the inverse of what I had experienced, you know, going to parties with Jamie's family. Mm-hmm. So there were some barriers there, and sometimes it's hard to talk about these things, because for me to bring that up to Jamie, it could be taken as I'm complaining about his language.
Right.
And it could be taken that way. So there were a lot of things that we didn't really communicate about, partly because we didn't know how to articulate it, mm-hmm. or because maybe there was another battle that day, something much more pressing that really needed to be discussed. And, you know, you just kind of want to prioritize. So some of the things I don't know that we ever really resolved or addressed.
Now, were his parents accepting of you, and were your parents accepting of him?
Oh, Sakina, that's a great question. So my mother will always, if she were in the room, she would say, I always had a dream of an Asian boy. And now I know that it was, you know, it was a dream that it, you know, Jamie and all these things, and, you know, and I laugh because, you know, 19 years later, we still hear the same story about the precious dream. Asian boy in her dream all those years ago. And, so I don't think, how do I say this? Forgive me. I don't really see that there was an issue on my family. There shouldn't be. Oh my gosh, this day and age, there shouldn't be an issue at all, right? There, I think because Jamie was different from what they're used to. My parents grew up in the Belleville, Newark area, where people were mostly Italian or Irish back when they grew up here. So that's just what they grew up used to. And I think when we encounter something that's not what we're used to, something different, we always don't know how to respond. And so sometimes we respond with humor just to kind of bring ourselves through as we navigate something that's just other than what we're used to. And so humor at the expense of Jamie occurred within my family. And oftentimes we couldn't get through a holiday event, a family meal without, you know, my brother or my father making, you know, it might've just been silly. It might've been outright offensive. And I don't think that was the intention, but that was difficult because while they were very welcoming of Jamie and their beautiful biracial grandchildren, jokes were made. And, you know, for a person like such as Jamie, who is not as vocal as I am, somebody who maybe just puts all this on the inside, that's not the best thing. So I did find myself usually being the advocate and saying, hey, you know, can we just get through a meal without an Asian joke, please? Like, is that too much to ask, you know? And again, I don't think it was meant callously. So I'm not trying to knock anybody in my family. But that is the truth. And things like that take a toll on the relationship, because then if I'm the, not the protector, but if I'm the vocalizer in the group, a private or side conversation between the husband and wife might be, well, they're your family, and why didn't you say anything? Or why don't you say anything? Mm-hmm. So those were conversations that happened. And as my, you know, priority became more, you know, my husband, my family, this little group that I have here, I became more vocal about that. And I'm proud that I was. And sometimes it was received well, sometimes it was laughed off. But I don't know that that's ever something that was really resolved. I mean, eventually we just got busy with kids, then we moved away. You know?
That'll happen, yeah.
And I mean, Sakina, you've got to figure after a decade or so, there's only A, so many jokes you can make. B, the novelty eventually wears off. So I just think, well, gosh, you know, after all these years, maybe we finally turned a corner.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, you know, my family has taken a lot of steps to really be very inclusive. For example, when my mother threw the baby shower when I was pregnant with our first daughter, Jamie and my first, you know, our first daughter, she went out of her way to order a lot of the popular Filipino dishes, since, you know, a lot of our guests were from Jamie's side. He has a bigger family than we do. She really went out of her way to make sure that, you know, his family felt like comfortable and welcome. And, oh man, I'll never forget that. Like, I know it sounds so simple, But when you grow up in a family where, or in a town where kind of everybody's the same, and there's just something that you're not used to come in, and just to see people really take a nice liking to it in a positive mm-hmm. way. I don't know if I'm saying it well or clearly. Oh my gosh, I sound so white right now.
That's all right.
It's just, I don't know. Proud mm-hmm. of my mama. Okay. Jamie, so now to answer your question, I'm sorry I'm so long-winded. To answer your question about Jamie's family. So he, when Jamie and I got together, his father was remarried. So his bio mom was living in the Philippines. His father was remarried to a white American, you know, from here in Jersey. And there was an age gap between Jamie's mom and his dad, and also a big age gap between his dad and his stepmom. So Jamie's father, his late father, I should say, you know, was significantly older than Jamie's mom and Jamie's stepmom. And I don't know why I'm saying that. It has nothing to do with me with the question. But so Jamie's stepmom is, you know, white, and his dad, obviously, his dad's Filipino, was Filipino. Yeah, so they were fine. Like, there were just a lot of mixed couples in Jamie's side of the family. Mm-hmm. Mostly, like, one of the Filipino relatives with a white person. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only type of interracial relationship in his family. Not at all. So it's just kind of, it's no big thing. Like, right. Oh, this is your girlfriend. Oh, this is your boyfriend. Okay. Hi. Nice to meet you. Gotcha. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I did not perceive any, you know, anything about mm-hmm. that.
That's good. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to ask this question, and this is kind of a weighty question. Okay.
Okay.
So according to A.K. Foman and mm-hmm. T. Nance, who wrote From Miscegenation, I never can say that word right, to Multiculturalism.
Yes.
Perceptions and Stages of Interracial Relationship Development, Journal of Black Studies, they state that there are four stages in the healthy maintenance of interracial relationships. Mm-hmm. Now, I realize that you and Jamie are separated at the moment. That's correct, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So I would love for you specifically to mm-hmm. be able to answer these questions. Number one, sure. Do you believe that there are four stages? And I'll list those stages, and each mm-hmm. after each one, just let me know whether you agree or disagree and why or why not. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, the first one is racial awareness. That's discovering the perspectives of one partner's race and realizing the role race plays in one's life. Do you think racial relations is one of the stages of maintenance?
It definitely is, you know, and of course we must acknowledge that, you know, race is a social construct, given that it is, and it's so ingrained in our culture. Then yes, my answer is yes, I do think so.
Okay. So then the second one is coping with social definitions of race. That's okay. Learning strategies for dealing with racially biased reactions from society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I think that's an important part of
maintaining a healthy relationship? Acknowledging it first and then finding a way to deal with it.
Absolutely. And again, just because of how this is breached culturally, like, yes, my answer is yes. Sorry.
Uh-huh. That's okay. No, I love the extras. It's fine. Okay. Now, identity emergence. This is the couple begins to view themselves as having a unique identity, and that identity is merged. Do you see that?
I do. I see it more now than I did ever before.
Okay.
Yeah.
Having children, does that make it more so? So did you feel that way more after you had your girls or before?
I don't think it was tied in to having the children. I think it was tied into life experience and returning to academia and mm-hmm. just the discoveries I've made over the past few years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then number four is maintenance, incorporating new perspectives and strategies into one's life to maintain the relationship.
It's very important. And as you know, yes. And can you restate that one more time for me?
Yes. Maintenance, incorporating new perspectives and strategies into one's life in order to maintain the relationship.
That's huge. Mm-hmm. Yes. And regardless of what cultures or races are brought into the relationship, I think that goes across the board.
Yeah.
That's huge because, when we settle on a framework and we become complacent with anything really, there's no growth taking place or there's no openness for growth or new discovery. And that's not a very healthy thing at all. Mm. So especially that last point. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is great. These authors really know their stuff. I don't know their background, at all, but yeah. I would love to get my hands on more of their writings. For a very long time, that sounds like decades. My oldest is only 15. For the bulk of those 15 years, though, I had not raised my children as biracial children. And what I mean is, not that I tried to exclude any part of their father or me from how we raise the children. No. What I mean is, you know, in typical like white fashion, and I'm not hating, please don't. I hope none of the listeners feel like I am like internally racist toward myself. I'm not. What I'm trying to say is, you know, in typical like white US fashion, we just think about ourselves and how the world exists to us, how it appears to us, how it occurs for us, not ever really coming out of that. So egocentric is the word. I could only bring to my children my life experiences, or so I thought. I just went with how I saw the world and brought the children up that way. And I think as we traveled, as we experienced life on Guam, as I returned to school, and just keeping up with everything that's going on, everything now is just so racially charged, and it needs to be because so many things have been oppressed and put down, and now people are just done. People are done. They're tired of, not they, we are tired of having to fit a mold, mm-hmm. and all of that. And anyway, I realized that I'm only teaching my children how to navigate the world as a white woman in America.
Mm-hmm.
But my children are not white women in America. They're biracial young women in America. Mm-hmm. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I tried to include as well as I could aspects of their father's culture. And, you know, the language is such a huge part. You know, I'm an English lit major, so language is just, like I said, it's a huge part. And it's difficult for Jamie to teach them the language because he doesn't have somebody to easily converse with. Anyway, it can be done. But what I'm trying to say is, to the best of my ability, I always included the Filipino culture in my children's lives. But I never said, oh, you're white kids. You're white. I'm raising you as white kids. I just realized that I was, and I wasn't raising them as biracial. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense.
Especially because where we live is so diverse, but you know, my kids, their friend groups, my friend groups, we've got everything because this is the area where we live. Oh my gosh. On one block, all the different languages that are spoken. It's the coolest thing. It is just so amazing. And, these things are all really they're part of our identity. And my children have encountered not racism, given the current climate of our nation and how we experience the effects of white privilege so very much and so negatively, it's affected the children because people say, well, you're white. And so the kids have gotten tossed into this kind of pile, because they're fair skinned. Well, two of them are, believe it or not, all three of my children have different complexions, but I don't want to digress. and they said, you know, but mom, you know, I'm not white. I'm mixed. Mm-hmm. And it was just so weird, Sakina, to, after, you know, 15 years of being a parent to biracial kids, mm-hmm. to actually sit and say, oh my gosh, yeah, you're mixed. And that's a huge part of who you are, kids.
Right.
And trying to help my children develop the tools and the language to communicate to others who might not be behaving hatefully towards them, mm-hmm. But however it's being delivered, these words, for my children to be able to say, I'm mixed. I have these two important parts of me. I have this part from my mother and this part from my father, and they're equally as valid, equally as important. And it seems kind of obvious, like it shouldn't have to be said, but I guess it is. So, you know, my children have heard things like, well, because you're white, I'm just going to call you white. Mm. And they're like, well, then you're invalidating this other part of me. And my youngest, she's not fair skinned at all. My youngest is actually quite tan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think it's easier for her to just, and she's only eight, like race and culture relations, like that's not even in the brain and the vocabulary yet. And I thank God for that, this mm-hmm. innocence where kids can just be kids. And, you know, the friend group, her one friend speaks Arabic, French, and Spanish. Her other friend speaks Spanish. And, you know, Aubrey knows a little Tagalog. She speaks English. She's learning Spanish. And it's just the coolest freaking thing. And it's just, oh man, I just hope that innocence stays as long as possible.
Yeah.
Because the junior high and high schoolers, the stories they come home with.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah. So it's really challenging. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how the shift happened, but I'm glad it did. And I think it's just really important that my kids feel validated. And that all children feel validated and not minimized and not like they have to hide part of themselves. And I hope that I never ever created that for my children.
Right.
But gosh, it's just, I told you so many times already, right, that we lived in this bubble, Jamie and I, or at least I lived in this bubble. He didn't. He experienced the racism when he came to this country. He was called all of those slurs. That I don't even want to repeat, you know, that were just generalized for people of Asian descent. And, you know, and he lived in Jersey City when he moved here. It's not like, you know, not that it's okay anywhere, but my bubble and not Jamie's bubble, because he experienced New Jersey and he experienced the U.S. in a very different way.
Thank you for tuning into part two of The Cultural Divide. Join us next time for the highly anticipated episode 8, the culmination of this much-needed talk with Sarah, right here on Military Wife Matters.
We always want to send a huge shout-out to our sponsors. If you would like to be a sponsor of Military Wife Matters and support the work that we do here while sharing what you do with our listening audience, please email us at militarywifematters@gmail.com. Subject line, MWM Sponsorship. Today's broadcast has been brought to you by Anytime Fitness of Radcliffe. If you're looking to join a supportive, welcoming gym community with people of all fitness levels who want to see you succeed, you have come to the right place. Anytime Fitness of Radcliffe. Check them out at anytimefitness.com. Also by Allison Hermanson with Pampered Chef, dedicated to bringing memories to the table one meal at a time. For more information, you can connect with Allison on Facebook at Allison's Hot Dish. You wrote that great book. Now what? It's time to take that book and become a profitable entrepreneur. If you need help harnessing the power of digital marketing, allow certified digital marketing specialist Vanessa Collins to help you use the power of technology to build your business and increase your revenue. Her monthly memberships, Digital Mastery for Authors, will provide you valuable information on producing additional products and services. For more information, connect with Vanessa at digitalmasteryforauthors.com. And by Clean Good Eats, specializing in allergy-friendly and detox eating plans. Group and one-on-one coaching available to help you get your health back on track, restoring healthy relationships with food, others, and self. Connect with them at cleangoodeats.com.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Military Wife Matters, where we delve into the real-life issues concerning military wives across the nation. Join us next time as we bring to you those topics that matter most to you.